Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
We've been working on this season for months, and we knew right away there was no way to think about the current election without revisiting 1992. Then, like now, a record number of women ran for office. And, like now, it was being called the Year of the Woman. But this past weekend, we just felt like we had gotten into a time machine.
Ms. Katz, is your client willing to testify before the Judiciary Committee publicly and tell this story?
She is. She's willing to do whatever it takes to get her story forth, yes.
Does she think Judge Kavanaugh should withdraw his nomination? Is that what she hopes comes out of this?
She's not taking a position on that.
Christine Blasey Ford's allegations against Brett Kavanaugh make the comparison to 1992 inescapable. But what are we to take from that comparison? What can we learn from the previous Year of the Woman? In this episode, we look back at an election that is widely considered the beginning of the modern era for women in politics. It was the year when Washington's Old Boys Club finally began to pry open. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, Gender, Power, and the Midterm Elections. We're going to look at the 92 elections from the vantage of two women who were already on the inside, who were already trying to make one of Washington's most doggedly male institutions work for them, too. One woman is a famously moderate Kansas Republican.
This is Nancy Landon Kassebaum, and I served in the Senate from 1979 to 1997.
Only 13 women had ever been there when she arrived. Hundreds of male senators had come and gone, but just 13 women. And Kassebaum, a Republican, mind you, was just the second woman who got in without filling the seat of someone who had died.
And I was asked a lot of times, what's it like being only woman or one of a few? Do people view you as too weak? Are you strong enough? And I said, if I worried about all those kind of things, I'd never get anything done.
But she did. She was known as an ideological bridge between the parties, as someone who sought common ground to solve problems. And then in 1986, a Baltimore Democrat joined her in the Senate. And nobody ever asked if she was strong enough.
When I came to the Senate, everybody wondered, what would Barbara Mikulski be like? Would she be mouthy, bodacious? I already had a reputation for 10 years in the House of being pretty feisty and a strong advocate for what I believed in.
So here were these two women, different parties, very different styles altogether, inside this institution of just unequivocal male power. And you wouldn't have thought they had much in common.
But I have a wonderful story about Barbara Mikulski.
It was when they were invited to a diplomatic dinner.
For Mrs. Gorbachev. The Gorbachevs were in Washington, and it was very small.
This was just as the U.S. and the Soviet Union were trying to end the Cold War, trying to become new friends. And Raisa Gorbachev, who was something of a glamorous celebrity in her own right, wanted to meet notable American women.
It was a distinguished group. It was Senator Kassebaum and myself. It was Kay Graham from the Washington Post. It was the president of the University of Chicago. Sandra Day O'Connor was there.
And Mrs. Gorbachev spoke a lot and held up the conversation quite a bit. So after we came out, The press was all there, a lot of press outside the Harriman home. And Barbara stepped forward and she said, it's the first time I've been together with someone who spoke more than I did.
These two clearly enjoyed each other. And it makes sense. It was just the two of them and 98 men.
Well, everything about the Senate was organized around men. First of all, every podium, when you go to speak on the floor, was built for some guy who was 5'10" or 6'2".
But of course, it was about a lot more than podiums. Mikulski knew right away that if she was going to succeed, she'd have to crack the boys' code. So she identified her male allies, and she studied them.
How to get on that right committee. How to win my way in a seniority system when there was no other Democratic woman. And also, what were not only the formal channels of power in the Senate, but what were the informal channels?
The informal channels. Like the after-hours sessions she used to have with Ted Kennedy and Chris Dodd.
So Kennedy and Dodd, whenever I'd have a hard day, whenever there would be an old guy who thought he was being funny, but it was a joke from like 1840, we would go out to a restaurant called La Colleen. They would encourage me. They'd say, oh, he's a jerk. Don't pay any attention to him. Is he as boring with you as he is with us? And they would pour me another glass of wine. And Senator Kennedy would have his good old libation and so on. And I felt like I wanted to like spit in the bucket and go back the next day.
And that was the world of the Senate as of the summer of 1991, when Thurgood Marshall retired from the Supreme Court. Now, keep in mind, this is not just any Supreme Court justice. We're talking about a guy who, to many, is just as significant to civil rights history as Martin Luther King Jr.
Any action on the part of any official in Arkansas or any private individual to oppose desegregation of the schools of Little Rock is deliberately calculated violation of the law.
So this was a big moment, just like it is now, frankly. And what does President Bush do? He appoints Clarence Thomas, a black conservative who was primarily known for his opposition to affirmative action. That alone was explosive. And then,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurman, members of the committee, my name is Anita F. Hill, and I am a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma.
That's next.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Professor Hill, please make whatever statement you would wish to make to the committee.
The first thing was, after we learned of Professor Hill, was should she be allowed to testify? And I said, absolutely. We already had doubts of Clarence Thomas because of previous rulings. So in our own Democratic caucus, we said, I stood up and said, we must listen to her. We must give her a voice.
Just 2 days before the Senate was to vote on the nomination, Anita Hill's story broke. She told a horrific account of what it was like to work for Thomas when she served under him in the Reagan administration.
Can you tell the committee what was the most embarrassing of all the incidences that you have alleged?
I think the one that was the most embarrassing was his discussion of pornography involving these women with large breasts and engaged in variety of sex with
different people or animals. That was the thing that embarrassed me the most and made me feel the most humiliated.
She thought she was coming to a hearing. The Republicans on the Judiciary Committee had organized it as if it were a trial.
You said that you took it to mean that Judge Thomas wanted to have sex with you, but in fact, he never did ask you to have sex, correct?
No, he did not ask me to have sex. He did continually pressure me to go out with him, continually, and he would not accept my explanation as one as being valid.
It became a national event. Everybody tuned in to watch 14 white men, some of them still powerful figures in Washington today, interrogate this black woman on live television.
Nancy wasn't on the committee. I wasn't on the committee. And it was very clear that there had to be more women and that we needed to be on not only judiciary, we needed to be on every committee.
Hill's testimony did not keep Thomas from getting a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court. But for many women, the spectacle of her cross-examination changed things. And there was an election coming. That campaign season, it felt a lot like 2018. More women ran for federal office that year than ever before. And a lot of them won. Four more women came into the Senate, including the first ever black woman.
The guys at the door didn't want to let me in. They were like, where are you going? So,
Carol Moseley Braun was actually motivated to run even before Anita Hill emerged. The idea of Clarence Thomas taking over Thurgood Marshall's seat, that was enough to move her by itself. And the fact that her Democratic senator, Alan Dixon, planned to support Thomas's nomination?
I was horrified. And so my first move was to talk to our senator and to ask him if he understood the gravity of what it was that he was proposing to do. He did not, as it turned out.
So she ran against him, and she made the court a centerpiece of her campaign. But Anita Hill actually kind of complicated things because in the state's black community, some power brokers connected with Thomas's claim that he was, as he put it, victim of a high-tech lynching.
Being both black and female, I had to go into the black churches and understand that this was not something they wanted to talk about. Hmm. And frankly, it took one of my campaign workers to really draw the picture for me to make it make some sense to me. We were sitting up in a church one day and he pointed to the church, the choir was behind all the preachers, and all the preachers, the pastors were all male, and the choir was almost entirely female. Mm. And he said, that's why Anita Hill's not getting more support than she is in the black community. And that was true.
Braun navigated that tricky terrain and joined the historic class of 1992 in Washington. More women entered Congress that year than ever before. 24 women won new House seats in addition to the four women who came into the Senate. But Barbara Mikulski had already been in the Senate for a full term. So she understood something important about this moment.
Getting elected is only one step in the power paradigm. It's being effective and then knowing how to use the tools of power to make a change and to make a difference.
So she gathered all those notes she'd taken while watching her male allies, all the tips on formal and informal channels of power, and she turned them into a memo for the incoming women.
I organized a power workshop. Now, when the press heard that I was doing a power workshop, they said, well, what is that? Are you having a tea?
Actually, it was coffee.
It started off just as a coffee in her office. And then we started saying, let's do this more often.
Patty Murray was one of the four women who won Senate seats that year. She had been in the legislature in Washington State. But before Anita Hill, she says the U.S. Senate rarely even crossed her mind.
And, of course, the day after I won the election, it was like, oh, my gosh, now what do? I have to pack my clothes and move to D.C. I've got to find a place to live. I need to, you know, dive into this. And there was Barbara Mikulski, and she was amazing.
Murray may have been overwhelmed initially, but she and her fellow newcomers walked out of that first coffee meeting with a clarity of purpose.
We wanted to achieve things. We wanted to be respected so that other women could do this.
Over the next 25 years, Mikulski became known as the Dean of the Senate Women. She raised money to get women elected. She pushed party leadership to put women in real positions of authority. And as Republican women began winning office, she organized across the aisle as well. She retired in 2016, having spent more years in the Senate than any woman in history. By that time, the chamber looked a lot different than the one she and Nancy Kassebaum entered. It is arguably the most powerful legislative body in the world. Women went from 2% of that body in 1991 to nearly a quarter of it today. That's still not half, but it's a huge shift. And several of those women are likely presidential candidates. And, not for nothing, there is now at least one woman on every Senate committee. That all feels great, like real progress toward an actually representative democracy. And this year, the record-breaking gender gap that everybody expects in November may well create another big, radical shift in Washington's power structure.
But, you know, the fact is that it's 26 years later, and we're still talking about the fact that having a whole bunch of women run for Congress is worthy of a news story. Tells you that women are still seen as an anomaly and not as some normal part of the political scene.
That's Amy Walter. She's the national editor of the Cook Political Report and a host of The Takeaway here at WNYC. People like Amy, who have been watching elections for decades, say, sure, 1992, it was exciting and it was progress. But it's too easy to forget what happened just 2 years later in the 1994 elections.
With resignation, but with resolve, I hereby end 40 years of democratic rule of this House.
History has recorded 94 as a Republican wave election for Newt Gingrich and his contract with America. But a couple things have been forgotten. First off, the themes were familiar to 2016.
Now, I recognize, sadly, that the Washington Press Corps is all too often the Praetorian Guard of the left.
And more than that, 1994 made history as a year of the man. Ever since the Civil Rights era, the male vote in presidential elections has trended to Republicans, a pattern driven by a huge migration of white men after Democrats embraced black voters. Congressional elections, however, they weren't so gendered. Not until 1994, when white men moved en masse to support congressional Republicans. One way to look at this is the politicians themselves. Nearly 9 out of 10 House Republicans today are white men, while 6 out of 10 House Democrats are women or people of color. So the bitter partisan divide that we talk about now, it can also be understood as a divide over gender and race. And Amy Walter says that has been around from the beginning.
But you know what? There are structural challenges for women that go much deeper to the origins of power, to who wrote the rules and who still benefits from the rules, right? And the fact is, the structures were built by and for certain people, and women weren't around the table when those structures were being built.
So what are those structures? What are the foundations of political power in America, and why have women struggled to move them? We'll be exploring that question throughout this podcast, starting with the moment when women did claim a seat at the table of democracy, or at least some women.
They're trying to say, no, it's not going to shake up the social foundations of your state and of your culture because there are more white women than black women. And so white supremacy is secure.
That's next on the United States of Anxiety. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios and the newsroom of WNYC. This episode was reported by me and our producer, Jessica Miller. Casey Means is our technical director. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Andy Lancet is our archivist. This episode was edited by Christopher Wirth, Kari Pitkin, and Karen Frillman, who is also our executive producer. Jim Schachter is vice president of news for WNYC, and I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for listening. The United States of Anxiety is supported in part by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Additional support for WNYC's election coverage is provided by Emerson Collective, the New York Community Trust, and New York Public Radio trustee, Dr. Mary White.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.